This episode of Felon may contain disturbing content, including descriptions of violence and coarse language. Listener discretion is advised.
On the 8th of September, 2013, at approximately 2:30 a.m, Jean Redmond stirred from her sleep to the sound of shuffling coming from the room of her flatmate. As she listened closely, she could hear faint scratching, similar to the scratching of chalk on a board. This scratching was soon followed by a thump, then a mumbling, which became what sounded like snoring, except it was different from the usual sound of snoring that she was used to hearing. It seemed louder. Jean had previously woken up when her flatmate, Morgan Huxley, had entered his room around an hour earlier. She had assumed that he'd gone to sleep, and she tried to do the same. But now this strange series of noises had stirred her. After around 5 minutes, the irregular snoring had not stopped. Jean got up out of bed and made her way to the nearby room to investigate. The scene waiting for her, only meters from where she had been sleeping, would be horrific. In the doorway of his bedroom, Jean's flatmate, Morgan, was lying on the ground and bleeding from what appeared to be a wound to his neck. In a panic, Jean quickly alerted emergency services and also called her boyfriend for assistance. Despite the obvious loss of blood, Jean attempted to perform CPR on Morgan while she anxiously awaited the arrival of paramedics. Upon hearing the shocking news, Jean's boyfriend finished his shift at work and made his way to the scene. He arrived to find Jean performing CPR on Morgan and observed that Morgan's shorts were pulled down, leaving him exposed below the waist. Out of respect, he placed a towel over the lower half of Morgan and made his way downstairs to keep an eye out for the ambulance. As the howl of sirens drew near, Morgan was barely clinging to life. Paramedics arrived and did the best they could to treat a large puncture wound to the neck and a number of what appeared to be stab wounds to Morgan's torso, upper arms, back and head. Morgan was rushed to the Royal North Shore Hospital, but due to the amount of blood observed on the floor and the bed of his room, those treating him held grim fears for his survival. Soon after his arrival at the hospital, Morgan Huxley lost his life to his many brutal wounds. An autopsy revealed the full extent of his injuries. It was determined that Morgan had died as a direct result of multiple stab wounds inflicted by a sharp knife. These consisted of over 20 stab wounds to the middle and upper back, neck and head. Injuries sustained from the knife attack included internal hemorrhaging, penetration of the chest cavity, injury to the lungs, severing of the carotid artery, and damage to the jugular vein. An X-ray also revealed a piece of metal deeply embedded in his skull. Before discovering Morgan collapsed on the floor, Jean recalled that approximately an hour prior, she had heard him return from a night out and enter his room. Not long after, she heard a faint tapping on the front door, followed by a more distinct, much louder knock. Assuming it was just a friend of Morgan's, she thought nothing of it and had drifted off to sleep. Confronted with such a savage attack, investigators wasted no time in their search for this violent killer and locked down the surrounding area of Neutral Bay as police trawled for evidence. Neutral Bay is a suburb of Sydney, located on the Lower North Shore, approximately 5 kilometres from the CBD. It sits nestled among an affluent pocket of northern suburbs, boasting a wide range of cafes, restaurants, pubs, pristine parks, and harbour views. It was here, in this relatively peaceful suburb, that the victim, 31-year-old Morgan Huxley, lived in a two-story apartment on Watson Street with his flatmate, Jean Redmond. Being single at the time, Morgan enjoyed a very active social life. He was known to come and go at various hours, and Jean would have thought nothing of his late arrival or even a visitor stopping by. Despite this healthy social life, Morgan also worked extremely hard to establish and run his own business, Huxley Marine. It was under this name that he worked as a wharf engineer. Being located in the harbourside suburb of Neutral Bay provided the perfect surroundings for his line of work, specialising in the building and repair of aquatic-related construction projects, such as seawalls, ramps, jetties and boat sheds. In the weeks leading up to the murder, Morgan had been hopeful that he was close to securing a contract for the construction of an ocean walkway on the central coast, further progressing his business venture. In what should have been a time of celebrations for new beginnings, had quickly come to a bitter end. Given the violent nature of the attack, there was obvious pressure to find the offender. Initial inquiries focused on those close to Morgan, but Morgan seemed well-liked in his social circles, and it didn't seem like he had crossed anyone who would wish him harm. Police were at a loss to find any individual who would have a motive to carry out such a random and brutal attack. The media circus swarmed on the case, speculating to the point of slander of possible motives for the killing. These ranged from jilted lovers through to whispers of threats from a former business associate. These leads made for provocative headlines, but proved to be nothing more than clickbait for the media machine. Attention was directed at the nearby areas of Neutral Bay. Prior to the attack, Morgan had walked a mere 200 metres home, and investigators hoped that someone had seen or heard something. Police conducted canvasses of the area. They spoke to neighbours, bar staff, storeholders, and any witnesses who could have seen Morgan in the lead-up to his murder. While forensic investigators focused on the scene of the crime, detectives began to track down his last known movements, using both witness statements and CCTV footage of the area. On the afternoon of the 7th of September, the day prior to the early morning attack, Morgan had driven to the neighbouring Lower North Shore suburb of Lane Cove, about a 15-minute drive from Neutral Bay. There he attended an engagement party of a close friend, Chris Maroney, and fiancée Philippa. He remained at the party for several hours until it wrapped up at around 12:30 a.m. Along with Chris and Philippa, who lived nearby, Morgan caught a taxi back to Neutral Bay. Morgan was keen for one more round of drinks, but his friends were ready to call it a night, and he was not able to persuade them to join him. With his heart still set on one more drink, Morgan said goodbye to his mates, exited the taxi on Watson Street, and walked alone to his favourite pub, the Oaks Hotel, located on the corner of Military Road and Ben Boyd Road. Barefoot, after leaving his thongs at the engagement party, he ambled his way through the familiar streets of his neighbourhood. Along the way, Morgan stopped briefly at a convenience store and used an ATM to withdraw money before entering the pub. Once inside the Oaks Hotel, Morgan sat alone, quietly drank a beer and watched the television. Staff at the pub were familiar with Morgan and were able to assist police with their inquiries. Last drinks were called just prior to the pub's closing time of 1:30 a.m. and at this point, Morgan exited the venue and started his walk home. CCTV footage places this time at 1:28 a.m. It was also at around this time that Jean Redmond would enter her apartment and retire for the night. It would be another hour before she would exit her room and make the gruesome discovery of Morgan in the doorway of his room, covered in blood and fighting for his life. With no other leads, police continued to focus their attention on the CCTV footage. One individual in particular caught the attention of detectives. A young man dressed in a black top and what appeared to be chef-style checkered pants was seen on a number of occasions in close proximity to Morgan, and at times, even walking behind him. With a still frame image of the individual, detectives made their way to Neutral Bay to interview shop owners, restaurant staff, and local businesses with the hope that they could identify this individual. 2 weeks had now passed, and police were desperate in their search for a breakthrough. On the 24th of September, they finally made an important discovery. Staff from the Sydney Cooking School were able to provide police with a valuable piece of information: the identity of the mystery man in the CCTV footage. His name was Daniel Jack Kelsall. Commonly going by his middle name, Jack, Kelsall had approached business owner Brett Deverell and had inquired about employment. Due to his relevant experience, he was put on as a cleaner and kitchen hand, assisting with the food preparation, and cleaning up for group cooking classes run by the school. At the age of 17, 3 years prior to joining the team at the cooking school, Jack had enrolled in a hospitality course at a college. Upon the completion of this course, he attempted to pursue a career as a chef, but struggled with some of the basic requirements of the job. Despite not continuing as a chef, this educational experience put him in good stead for the position at the Sydney Cooking School, the location of which was just under 100 metres away from the Oaks Hotel, on the opposite side of Military Road. Staff from the cooking school were able to identify Kelso from his thin build, distinct curly hair, and glasses. He was described by colleagues as being a fairly reserved young man who kept to himself and quietly went about his work in the restaurant. The owner of the Sydney Cooking School was asked by police to put them in contact with Jack, and he was quickly ushered in to be interviewed at the North Sydney Police Station. Kelso had been seen on a number of occasions in the vicinity of Morgan in the surveillance footage they had obtained. While in the convenience store, they were seen to have a brief interaction, as Morgan, affected by alcohol, had struggled to use the ATM. Kelso could also be seen lingering outside the Oaks Hotel while Morgan enjoyed his last drink. When Morgan had exited the pub, Kelso had even walked in the same direction. Kelso attended the station, dressed in a black hoodie and a shoulder bag draped across his chest. During his interview with detectives, Kelso was shown the footage from a range of cameras. He calmly confirmed that it was him he could see in the vision. He was questioned as to why, at some points in the footage, he could be seen running in the same direction as Morgan. Kelso shrugged this off as his way of staying warm on a cold night.
Why'd you jog?
It's cold. Mum always tells me if you're cold, go for a jog.
How far did you jog for?
Not very far.
How far is not very far?
Oh, maybe. I don't know. From the lights, a little bit after the lights, to a little bit before the opening to the restaurant, the Oaks restaurant.
Where you were over here on Bimboyd Road, and then you've indicated you've sort of walked back up Military Road, across Watson. If you're cold, I'm just wondering why you would go that way. That doesn't look like the most direct route.
I don't know. I don't. When I get tired, I don't really pay attention to a lot of things. I think it was because I wanted to check in at work, the front of work. I might be the only person to tell you where my boss was as well, but I'm not very good at remembering things.
Sorry, you're not very good at remembering things.
Not fine details, no.
Police spent a number of hours with Kelso, asking him to retrace his steps and explain what he's doing in the area at the time. Throughout the interview, Kelso, with a distinct New Zealand accent, was cooperative, softly spoken, and politely offered his account of his movements on that night. He explained that after finishing his shift at the cooking school in the early hours of the morning, he had returned to the premises shortly after because he had forgotten to turn off a light. Coincidentally, it was around this time that Morgan was also making his way along Military Road. He stated that on his way home, he stopped at various points to inspect items that had been dumped on the pathway due to an upcoming hard rubbish collection. He also shared that he was stalling due to not wanting to be caught by his parents for being out too late. When asked if he recalled seeing Morgan that evening, he acknowledged that he saw a man matching his description crossing the road. He remembered this because he had observed and commented to a nearby security guard that he was not wearing shoes and referred to him as No Shoes.
You called him No Shoes?
No, not to his face. No, that's what...
No, sorry, but that's what you said.
The name that I had for the person was No Shoes.
No Shoes. Have you ever seen him before?
No.
Never?
Not to my knowledge.
Sorry?
Not to my knowledge, no. I mean, it's possible that I may have walked
sure.
Cross paths.
But you don't know him?
No.
As part of the interview formalities, police requested fingerprint and DNA samples. Kelso politely declined this request, stating that he felt uncomfortable in doing so. Although his actions in the proximity to Morgan were strange, and his mannerisms and explanations were observed by police to be odd, without any evidence, they had no choice but to let him go. On the 26th of September, 2 days following this interview, Detective Mark Dukes, who had conducted the initial interview with Kelsall, received a call from him stating that he had not been entirely truthful with them. He wanted to meet to share something that he had left out of his initial statement. Mark Dukes, accompanied by fellow detective Senior Constable Adcock, made their way to an arranged meeting place at the Woolworths car park in Neutral Bay. During this follow-up meeting, Kelsall gave a verbal statement and revealed that he had in fact been in Morgan's home in the early hours of the morning in question. He claimed that he had spoken to Morgan in the street and observed that he seemed upset. As the two continued their conversation, Kelsall had asked Morgan if there was any way he could cheer him up. According to Kelsall, they both walked home to Morgan's apartment together and went upstairs to Morgan's room, where they shared an intimate encounter. As a conclusion to this surprising admission, Kelsall also shared that as he was leaving, he'd passed a blonde woman walking towards Morgan's apartment. Soon after making this statement, Kelsall was arrested and taken to the North Sydney Police Station. But during this follow-up interview with police, his demeanour changed from the last time he spoke with them. Rather than cooperating, he refused to talk. He even refused to admit to the recent revelation he had shared with the detectives at the shopping centre car park. This interaction had not been recorded, and without anything new to add to evidence, Kelsall was again free to go. Prior to this interaction, he was on the investigator's radar, but with this recent admission, although undocumented, he was now without a doubt the main person of interest. The burden of finding evidence against Kelsall now rested on the investigators. By this point, Kelsall had given them enough reason to obtain various search warrants. On the 8th of October, with these warrants in hand, detectives attended Kelsall's residence and again he was arrested. Back at North Sydney Police Station, under the advice of a solicitor, Kelsall again declined to be interviewed. Based on the evidence police had so far, Kelsall was charged with the murder of Morgan Huxley and was required to remain in custody. Despite his previous refusal to cooperate, DNA and fingerprint samples were now able to be taken. Despite having Kelsall locked away, with the intention that he would stand trial, police continued their search for evidence to add to what they had uncovered so far. Part of this involved digging into Kelsall's past for any signs of violent tendencies. Daniel Jack Kelsall was born in Wellington, New Zealand, in February of 1993, and was adopted at birth. His parents also adopted two other children, a younger sister and an older brother. All reports indicate that Kelsall and his adoptive siblings were brought up in a loving and nurturing family environment. Kelsall described himself as a nerd or a geek, and was socially awkward in his interaction with others. In his spare time, Kelsall would play role-playing board games, competitive card games, Pokemon, video games, and chess. He also enjoyed reading fantasy and science fiction novels. While at school, he reported difficulties, most of which he claimed were due to him being separated from his friends when they had transferred to other classes or schools. Kelsall's secondary education ended when the Montessori school he was attending closed down. He attempted to complete his education by correspondence, but this was unsuccessful due to claims that he had concentration issues and was easily distracted. At age 17, Kelsall enrolled in a hospitality course at a college consisting of a 12-month, full-time food preparation and culinary arts certificate before commencing an apprenticeship as a chef. Halfway through the year, his parents and sister moved from New Zealand to Sydney in order for his father to establish a business. His brother had also moved out of home, so Kelsall went to live with a relative of a family friend. Kelsall stated that he found this separation from his family to be difficult, and he spiraled into a depression. Soon after the completion of his course, Kelsall joined his family in Sydney. He attempted to pursue a career as a chef, but found he was unsuitable because he had difficulties with measurements and could not understand the subtleties of things such as a pinch of salt. But with his experience, Kelsall took the position of a kitchen hand. In recent years, Kelsall had experienced a significant history of struggling with his mental health and had sought counselling and medical guidance. In 2010, while still in New Zealand, Kelsall had attended appointments with a general practitioner and a psychiatrist. During discussions with his GP, Kelsall had expressed concerns regarding sleep disturbance that he was experiencing. He also revealed that he was having thoughts of suicide and that he enjoyed inflicting pain on others on past occasions. With these revelations, Kelsall was prescribed an antidepressant and was referred to a mental health team. The notes provided by the psychiatrist that Kelsall met with indicated that he was inclined to a diagnosis of bipolar disorder. With this diagnosis, Kelsall was prescribed an antipsychotic and mood stabilizer called Seroquel. Kelsall had claimed that this medication had been helpful. After a third and final review in December of 2010, Kelsall was discharged from a crisis team care and was provided with 3 months' supply of Seroquel. Following his move to Australia, he continued taking this medication, and under medical advice, the dose was increased. In September of 2011, Kelsall's doctor referred him to a psychiatrist, and he saw him for a one-off consultation. During this appointment, the doctor concluded that Kelsall was not bipolar, but rather was just depressed. He noted that if Seroquel was providing relief for his symptoms, then it was worth continuing with. In early 2012, during a follow-up visit with a GP, Kelsall attempted to obtain a prescription for a course of Seroquel, but during this meeting, he was informed that Seroquel was not available for him under the pharmaceutical benefit scheme for a person in his situation. Kelsall was weaned off the medication over the period of a month with the advice to meet with a psychiatrist. On the 15th of May 2012, just over a year before the murder of Morgan Huxley, Kelsall met with a general practitioner, Dr. Susan Allman. During this appointment, he revealed that he had been experiencing intrusive thoughts that involved harming others. These thoughts were specific and graphic in nature. They involved killing people with a knife while walking home at night. In a follow-up consultation with another psychiatrist, he again shared that he had been experiencing thoughts of killing someone. He told the psychiatrist that he knew it sounded psychotic and that these thoughts had entered his mind when his depression had been at its worst. Kelsall was referred to psychologist Dr. Abdul Sayed, and he attended his first session with him on the 19th of June 2012. From early in his interactions with Kelsall, Dr. Sayed found him to be difficult to engage. His observations were that it seemed that anger was a part of his internal psychic world, and it seemed that it was a defense to keep from feeling emotions. His belief was that this internal anger did not cross over into any actions. Kelsall denied any significant feelings of anxiety, depression, self-harm, or homicidal ideas. Over the 10 monthly sessions that Dr. Sayed spent with Kelsall, he formed the belief that even though he had shared some disturbing thoughts in the past, based on his demeanor and his history of self-reporting, Kelsall did not pose a significant risk to himself or others. But it seemed now that Kelsall had proven Dr. Sayed wrong in his diagnosis, and his violent fantasies had now crossed over into reality. With Kelsall in custody, and police gaining further insight into his state of mind, the pieces of the puzzle were falling into place. The physical evidence found at the crime scene was now starting to paint a vivid picture. Now that they were able to access DNA samples and fingerprints from Kelsall, investigators would make a number of important forensic discoveries. These breakthroughs would be what they needed to finally prove what they had already come to believe about Kelsall's involvement in the murder of Morgan Huxley. Fingerprints left on Morgan's bedroom door belonged to Kelsall. Spots of blood belonging to Morgan, despite an effort being made to clean them, were on Kelsall's shoulder bag. This was the same bag that Kelsall had been carrying when he attended the police station for his first interview. Even more disturbing, and offering further insight into Kelsall's motivation, was the discovery of Kelsall's DNA on Morgan Huxley's exposed genitals. Faced with this undeniable evidence against him, Kelsall made one more addition to his revelation that he had shared with detectives in the shopping centre car park. His explanation for his DNA and fingerprints being left at the scene was that he and Morgan had been intimate the morning Morgan was murdered, and that following this interaction, someone had entered the room and hit Morgan on the head. These claims would prove to be nothing more than a fictitious decoy attempting to deflect the blame for his brutal actions. Throughout his trial leading up to the sentencing hearing, Kelsall maintained the claim that he was innocent and continued to plead his fabricated story of a romantic interaction that had been interrupted by a mystery woman. But the evidence presented left little doubt of his guilt, and it painted a gruesome picture of what had occurred in the early hours of the morning of the 8th of September. Dismissing Kelsall's obvious lies, The following account of events leading up to and including the murder of Morgan Huxley was presented to the court. It was based on witness accounts, CCTV, and forensic evidence located at the scene. As documented on CCTV, Morgan and Kelsall's paths crossed as the pair had both entered a convenience store, Morgan to use an ATM and Kelsall to buy a drink, a chance meeting that would ultimately seal Morgan's fate. In his interview with police, Kelsall was able to describe Morgan and the encounter quite vividly, even recalling that he could smell alcohol on him. Based on the CCTV footage, it appeared that he took an interest in watching Morgan's movements from this time on. They interacted briefly in the store and both exited. As Morgan crossed the road, Kelsall lingered on the footpath outside, all the while his gaze set on Morgan, at one point commenting to a security guard that Morgan wasn't wearing any shoes and giving him the nickname of No Shoes. Kelsall recalled to police that he had observed Morgan to be refused entry at one door of the Oaks Hotel. He walked across Ben Boyd Road and then back to the Oaks Hotel, where he was able to gain entry through another door into the less formal area of the bar. As Morgan sat in the hotel, Kelsall could be seen lurking on the footpath, sipping from a Powerade bottle and peering through the window in Morgan's direction. At 1:28 a.m, Morgan was seen exiting the venue and walking in the direction of his home. Kelsall began to follow, at times jogging to maintain a close distance between them. At the traffic lights at Military Road and Watson Street intersection, Kelsall was seen crossing immediately behind Morgan. The two then disappeared out of the view of any cameras. A short time after, inside Morgan's home, Morgan's flatmate Gene Redmond heard a faint knocking at the door, followed by a louder, more distinct knock. Disregarding this as a friend of Morgan's, she went back to sleep. It was now apparent that this was Kelsall tapping at the door. After knocking, Kelsall then tried the door handle and discovered it was unlocked. He made his way through the downstairs entry door and upstairs towards the bedrooms. The first room he came to was Morgan's, where he discovered him lying on his bed, drifting off to sleep and incapacitated by the drinks of the day and into the night. Kelsall opened the door, leaving fingerprints. He leaned over Morgan, pulled down his shorts, and groped him. Morgan, who was suddenly startled by this, reached out blindly towards the barely visible intruder. It was at this point that Kelsall started to repeatedly stab at him, and Morgan raised his arms in an attempt to defend himself. But being unarmed and under the lingering effects of the alcohol in his system, Morgan was unable to fight. Almost 30 stab wounds to his back, head, and neck would leave him sprawled on the floor, barely clinging to life. Kelsall fled, taking Morgan's phone as he raced down the stairs and then towards his home in Spruson Street, just over a kilometre away. Gene Redmond, woken by strange noises, would then make the gruesome discovery. As part of the investigation, Kelsall was also found to have in his possession animated films depicting the sexual abuse of children.
The trial of the man accused of murdering Morgan Huxley in Neutral Bay has heard that the suspect, Daniel Jack Kelsall, had told his doctor about a disturbing fantasy more than a year earlier.
The GP says that Daniel Jack Kelsall spoke to her about these intrusive thoughts about 16 months before he allegedly stabbed Morgan Huxley to death. Dr. Susan Allman told the court that Kelsall thought about killing someone with a knife on the way home from work at night. Now, the Huxley family watched from the gallery as she said Kelsall told her he took a knife home one night but didn't meet anyone. The defence questioned whether these thoughts were simply a byproduct of the medication he had been on, but she didn't think so. Now, the Crown is expected to wrap up its case tomorrow, leaving the defence to call Kelsall himself to give that explanation we've been promised.
On the 29th of April, 2015, Daniel Jack Kelsall was sentenced for the murder of Morgan Huxley. It took a Supreme Court jury just over 2 hours to find the now 22-year-old guilty of the crime. He was sentenced to 40 years and 3 months in prison, with a non-parole period of 30 years. Kelsall would be eligible to apply for parole in 2044.
Today in the Supreme Court of New South Wales, a jury of 5 men and 7 women found Daniel Jack Kelsall guilty of murdering Morgan Huxley as he lay in his bed in his Neutral Bay apartment. When the verdict was read, Morgan Huxley's family, many of whom had been sitting at the trial for the entire 8 days of evidence, let out a guttural sob. They let out cries as they heard each verdict, which was guilty to murder and guilty to indecent assault.
An inspiring, generous and loving young man, Morgan was beginning to make his way in the world. He had hopes and dreams that he will never be able to realise. He will never get married and never enjoy running around a park with his children. His life was stolen by a worthless psychopath.
Kelsall's family were emotionless, as was Kelsall himself, as he sat in the dock. Kelsall didn't look at his mother, who was trying to catch his gaze. Kelsall seemed like an unlikely murderer. His family described him as timid, shy, reliable, and incapable of cruelty. He had suffered from depression in the past, but he had never acted violently or lashed out at them. He had a close relationship with his mother, even bringing her chocolate and sweets home from work every
night. As a chilling postscript to this story, throughout the investigation of Morgan Huxley's murder, it came to light that at least two other men on separate occasions had been approached in a creepy interaction by an individual bearing a striking resemblance to Kelsall. Following Kelsall's arrest and his image being shared, two men came forward and reported encounters with an individual that they were certain was him. Months prior to the murder, one of the men claimed that he had gone outside for a cigarette when suddenly he was startled by someone bearing Kelsall's likeness pouncing out at him from behind a shrub before being chased away. Another man told police that he was certain it was Kelsall who had stalked him to his door on a walk home one night, but had quickly run away when confronted. This interaction had occurred only 1 week after the murder of Morgan Huxley. The family and friends of Morgan Huxley were left devastated in the wake of Daniel Jack Kelsall's actions, and left wondering what would lead him to commit such a violent and despicable act. But in the words of Justice Holm, the sentencing judge, the killing of Mr. Huxley was done for no other reason than to serve some irrational purpose known only to the offender. He continued, "The murder was utterly senseless and needless. It must have been the doing of a very disturbed individual." Following his sentence, 4 years after the death of Morgan Huxley, Daniel Jack Kelsall, who was often referred to as the Babyface Killer due to his youthful appearance, appealed the sentence handed down based on the argument that he felt his age at the time of the murder was not properly considered. But failing to convince the judges at the appeal, Kelsall's request was rejected based on the opinion that rehabilitation seemed questionable because of the nature of the murder, the applicant's thoughts, and his continued lack of remorse.
Do you own many knives?
We as a family do. I have the two knives that I showed you, and then the sword, which doesn't technically classify as a knife. And then there's the knives that we, the Kelsall's own, which now are all the ones that we can remember. On the other knives, I guess you could say I have access to would be the ones at work.
Have you taken any knives from work?
No.
When you got home and used the internet, did you have to log on to anything?
No.
Who is your provider of this?
Felon True Crime.